I'm Fathery.
This is Dave.
And this is Text Trek.
Engage.
So we've had a lot of Star Trek Discovery news from the last couple of weeks.
Where was all this when we needed it?
Yeah, the month of June has seen a lot of things come out. We've had several different people doing interviews, and we've learned a lot in the last month.
It's clear the embargo is off.
Yeah, they're moving now into the big marketing push, which mm-hmm. you can kind of expect for a big, high-budget show these days.
I guess once the trailer came out, that kind of got the momentum going.
Yeah. Yeah, that was kind of the start, and we'll see more and more and be covering more and more on Text Trek.
But this is awesome because we have, like, all sorts of legit stuff, and we don't have to make up as many guesses.
Yeah, well,
what's with the Klingon ghost ship? We don't know.
We kind
of... The sarcophagus
of,
ship.
We kind of have some more things to build new speculation off of.
Right,
now.
Sure.
I guess the biggest thing we've learned recently is we finally have the release date, which a lot of people have been, I don't want to say whining about not having a release date, but whining about.
I think, you know, everybody wants, I say everybody wants it to succeed. I think people want it to succeed, and the longer they delayed it, I think the more they got antsy that it was going to, like, delays meant badness, and that mm-hmm. meant that they were doing injury to Star Trek as a legacy.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a little bit maybe reading into it. I mean, there's so many different reasons why it could have been done. They might be right.
Well, I think a big thing is just the medium that they're using for the show. The online streaming distribution.
Right.
I think the people developing that type of content don't feel as much schedule pressure. You know, they're not worried about they have to hit a certain air date to fill a TV slot. And that's why, I've talked about this before, things like Netflix, they normally don't release the release date. You know, they don't clarify the specific
release
date.
Until, like, a week before.
Yeah, until, like, they cut it very close. And, you know, that's because they want to give the creators as much time as possible to make the best product. And,
right.
And I guess we should actually say the release date. It's going to be Sunday, September 24th.
Yes.
And the way that they're going to... show the first episode, it will be a two-parter, like most of the Star Trek shows, everything excluding the original series. The first part will air on CBS after the football games that day, and then the second part will be on CBS All Access. If you're in the United States, most of the rest of the world will watch it the following day on Netflix. We'll have seven...
The 24th is 2 days before my birthday.
Yes.
So it's very important that they get this right for me. I'm like, CBS, you can make me very happy.
So you can celebrate your birthday and the launch of Star Trek Discovery...
That's right.
...the same week.
That's right.
We'll have seven episodes coming out in September, October, going till November 5th. Or, I'm sorry, it'll be eight episodes over 7 weeks. Then everything else will premiere sometime in 2018, starting in January. Mm-hmm. And the tie-in book by David Mack, Star Trek Discovery Desperate Hours, also has an official release date now. That'll be coming out on the 26th.
January? Or, I'm sorry,
September.
Yeah, September 26th?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And we also got a new look at the Star Trek Discovery, or I'm sorry, the USS Discovery. On the ship that will be the primary setting of the show. And we'll talk more about that in a future episode where we kind of talk about all the visuals we've seen for Discovery. Moving on, like I said, there were several interviews in June. One of the more notable ones was Nick Meyer talking to the website Trek Movie.
Is he Nick Meyer? It's not Nicholas Meyer?
Nicholas Meyer, but okay. We don't have time for
but
that.
But you know him. You know.
We don't have time for that, David.
Oh, okay. Son of a bitch.
But one of the things Meyer talked about...
Meyer, who was producing...
he's writing, yeah. I think he might have a producer credit also.
Right. And you might remember him from such movies as Wrath of Khan.
The Wrath of Khan. He co-wrote The Voyage Home, mm-hmm. and also wrote and directed Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country.
Yep.
He told Trek Movie, "One thing that has nothing to do with Discovery is that I am working on another Star Trek project, but I can't discuss that either." Trek Movie asked, "Are we talking more feature film? Because as far as I know, there is only one television project, I assume." Meyer replied, "You can assume." Very cryptic. Dave, what do you think of that?
I had forgotten that. I remember reading this, but I had forgotten that until you just now read it and surprised me on air and said, "What did I think of it?" you know, I had this feeling it's not going to be quite as big as people might want to speculate.
Yeah.
I don't think it's going to be a full-blown, like, sister series to it, although there are two ships. Maybe if there's not, like, a lot of death and mayhem in the first one and one of them is destroyed or lost, the Shenzhou is lost or something, you know, maybe it could somehow be about that ship. You know, maybe that's what they're preparing. That would be the craziest thing of all time if the Shenzhou got its own separate show and that's what he's talking about. But I'm going to guess it's some smaller project.
It could be something with like a 35th anniversary something for The Wrath of Khan.
Yeah.
It could be he might be co-writing a book.
Right.
Anything.
Right. I mean, I feel like if it was like a documentary he was taking part in, like he kind of you wouldn't if somebody is like if are you working on anything else Trek? I mean, I guess I could, yeah, you would probably say, yeah, I am, but I can't say what it is if it was just a documentary. So, yeah, I could see it being an anniversary thing. Obviously, he's going to be somebody you would talk to for an anniversary thing.
The reason why I bring this up is because Nick Meyer is obviously one of the greater contributors to Star Trek.
Mm-hmm.
Did three of the, probably the three best movies Star Trek has ever done. I always wanted him to be more involved, especially when Enterprise went off the air and we were wondering what would happen next, if anything, and then all of a sudden there's this talk of J.J. Abrams doing Star Trek movies. I always thought Nicholas Meyer would be a good go-to guy to maybe co-write a script, or I always felt like he wasn't being utilized anymore, and they needed to bring him in and, mm-hmm. and find a role for him. I don't know if I'd want him to like run a show himself, because as he admits, he initially wasn't a big Star Trek fan, and I think he has some problems with the kind of the more less grounded elements of Trek.
Right.
Like, I don't think he would have enjoyed working on Deep Space Nine, where you have, like, this Bajoran wormhole and kind of the weird religion around the prophets. He right. probably would like the war, the military aspect of it, but he kind of needs someone else to... someone who's more traditional Star Trek to get input from him.
Right.
I think that's the best way to use him.
Right. He seems to, you know, if I look at the projects that he worked on, he seems to always cut to the heart of, like, the characters. To like, the human underpinnings of whatever the broader science fiction happenings are. You know, Genesis is a, you know, in Wrath of Khan is a question about war, but it also relates to, you know, Kirk's loss of his youth, and, you know, there's like all these juxtapositions and things, but they all kind of like zero in on the characters, and for sure Undiscovered Country, you know, has to do with, you know, kind of these bigger questions about forgiveness and, you know, justice, empathy. It's the very human side of Trek, and a little bit less maybe the big idea mongering stuff, less V'ger, less mm-hmm. less aliens who speak in binary, you know, kind of stuff like
yeah.
that.
Yeah, anything that's more hard sci-fi, he's probably less interested in.
Right. What do you think he would stand on Darmok?
You know, that's it.
Because that's a very human episode too.
But I think Nick Meyer would have problems with, like, this guy looks like a bloated lizard. I don't know how to write for this.
Right.
I don't know how to direct. You know, he didn't want to do Star Trek 3, because he knew they were going to have to bring back Spock. And he says, like, I don't understand resurrection. That's not in my wheelhouse. I don't fucks with that.
Yeah. I mean, I get that. As a creator, you know, most writers are not going to... If you're not part of, like, a medium like... like comic books where... Specifically the genre of superheroes where that's such a staple of it. And, like, kind of, I guess that runs through action-adventure media. Most people, if they do a dramatic death, they want it to stick.
Yeah, he was pissed about that last shot in The Wrath of Khan where it showed the Genesis... Where Spock's torpedo on the planet Genesis. He actually didn't shoot that. He refused to, and someone else had to go shoot it.
Oh, interesting. I don't think I knew that. It is clearly we're leaving the door open. It also sort of worked, you know, had they not brought him back, it could have just showed, oh, it's a peaceful resting place among this idyllic sort of alien landscape. But, I didn't know that he particularly was a point of contention.
A Trek movie went on to say to Meyer, obviously there is much, much more Star Trek piled up on the shelf now that is harder to ignore. With Wrath of Khan, there really wasn't a lot. Now, there may even be too much to deal with. Meyer said, I think that is fair. What I can say is that Brian Fuller invented Star Trek Discovery, conceived it, he found a niche in the chronology that allows for another stream. Trek Movie asked, but it still fits as part of that chronology. But you feel there's freedom in that niche? Meyer said, yeah. Basically,
is he just talking about the time period they picked, that it was before most of the other TV shows?
I think so, but it sounds like they're...
And that actually sounds like a split time stream he's talking about.
It could be that. It kind of sounds like they want him to reaffirm that the show is set in the Prime universe.
Right, they're like, it does count, right?
Yeah, and you could interpret that as like, yeah, this will be like a different time stream or a different timeline, kind of like how the Kelvin movies were. I'm not really sure what to make of this.
I have a feeling that was just a slight linguistics fumble, because I don't think, honestly, Meyer would be very interested in the kind of, in like, I guess the depth of continuity that gets, you know, in which you start talking about parallel universes and, you know, which continuity line is real. It doesn't sound like where his heart is.
I think he would be interested in that if you're Brian Fuller and you kind of pitch it to him as, you know, if we just say that this changes the timeline, we'll have the freedom to tell our own stories, not have to worry about the other shows.
Right, they wouldn't have to worry about
the chronology that way.
Yeah, I could see that. He does seem like, you know, as they're correct in pointing out that Wrath of Khan, at that point, all they had to were three seasons of the original show.
In one movie.
One movie. Maybe the cartoon, if you want to count
that
it.
That doesn't count.
And that was it. But now there is tons more books, even, you know, just that push, even if they're not official, that the, you know, they push the fandom down certain paths of thinking.
For sure, yeah.
I'm going to go ahead and guess that is just him saying, we said it before Kirk's time, so we don't have as much baggage. That's my guess.
Yeah, and I can see that, and I kind of hope that is the case, because I don't really want another time stream.
Me neither.
If you want...
I don't want them to, by the way, reference anything related to the Kelvin time stream split. Ever and ever.
Okay. We need to have a conversation about that at a later point, because I have something that will contradict that, but I think I can convince you to agree with me.
There's no way you can.
Okay. we'll save that one for another time.
Okay, sounds good. I seem to remember you talking about this before, so I think I might know what you're talking about, but yeah. We'll get back to it.
Anyways, if you want to check out the entire interview with Nicholas Meyer, there will be a link posted in the description, so feel free to check that out over at trekmovie.com. Another interview that we'd like to talk about is producer Alex Kurtzman spoke with Collider recently. Alex Kurtzman, you might know as one of the co-writers of Star Trek 09 and Star Trek Into Darkness. Also co-writer of some really shitty Transformer movies that ruined the other half of my childhood that wasn't Star Trek. I'm not thrilled that his name is attached to Star Trek Discovery. And he was actually one of the original names attached to it. But I kind of feel like his involvement isn't as big as, some of the other producers and writers. Speaking to Collider, though, about Brian Fuller. He had something interesting to say. The quote is, "He's just unbelievably brilliant, and I really, really loved working with him, and I loved seeing the way that his mind worked. Brian was very involved in American Gods, and I think that the scope and scale of what Trek has become made it so that Brian elected to say, I don't want to shortchange either of these two things. They're both sort of beloved to him. So we sat down and we figured out how are we going to take what we can have of you and continue that through not only this season of Trek, but hopefully set up things that are coming next season. So much of what's there in terms of story, and certainly in terms of setup, character, big ideas, the big movement of the season, that's all stuff that Brian and I talked about." So what do you think of that, Dave?
I think that probably bodes well in the sense that it sounds like the guy that people most wanted, and that I sort of most wanted to see what his impact was going to be, sounds like he basically left enough notes to steer the guy who wrote Transformers down a better path than he would on his own. It sounds pretty positive. It's interesting to me that there are reverberations enough of their story that he would speak of it as getting into season two as well. But obviously, I mean, like, Fuller had to have been just doing like tons and tons of work if, you know, in the early stages of this. So it kind of makes sense.
And I've said for a long time, you know, go back and watch some of our previous podcast episodes. I've said that I think Brian Fuller is simply just too busy developing American Gods and Star Trek Discovery. I kind of wish that he dropped out of American Gods and hung out with Discovery because, you know, like you, I think that he was a good fit for the show and I wanted to have him involved in running the show. This also bodes well that, you know, they talk about setting up things for the second season, because Fuller says he'd love to come back just as a writer and contribute to the second season of Star Trek Discovery.
That'd be cool.
There's this idea that's been circulating that, yeah, CBS didn't like what Brian Fuller was doing, that he was making things too traditional Star Trek, so they fired him, and now it's going to be not Star Trek-y at all, and it's just going to be...
I've definitely seen this in message board circles.
Yeah, that's not the case. Based on everything I've seen and heard, you can be a conspiracy theorist, I guess, and suggest that they're just trying to cover up that Brian Fuller is actually fired, and for some reason Brian Fuller is part of this conspiracy. But, I don't know, just from where I'm standing, that doesn't look like the case at all.
I have a feeling that there are some people like me who really kind of resisted the Abrams movies, gave them a very jaundiced opinion of subsequent Trek projects, and so they're kind of like, they're ready to pounce. They're like, ugh, it's basically going to be more Abrams, more Kelvinverse, even though it's clearly not, but they think it's going to be too informed by those sort of sensibilities. Now, I even, like, somewhat warmed up, I feel like, to the Kelvin movies as kind of their own beast. I think that streak of cynicism is, like, what's pushing the conspiratorial theories. It's some people that those movies broke them.
Kurtzman went on to say, "The line between film and television is utterly blurred, not just at a storytelling level, but visually now. What we're doing on Star Trek right now, that's not that different from what we're doing in the movies. I think that's what people expect when they pay for Netflix or for HBO, or whatever they're going to pay for. That actually makes, as a storyteller, it makes it in the many ways, you're not limited, but oh, we could never really do that on television scope-wise, because now, take a look at Game of Thrones, that's a movie."
It's an interesting point. And sort of bolsters their notion for their CBS All Access, which is, you know, you're getting movie quality out of this, like the upper echelon of cable programming, where that's become the standard.
This isn't going to be like a typical CBS, like, this isn't going to be like NCIS in space, or this isn't going to be like Supergirl, which was on CBS the first season. You know, this is going to be a show...
More premium?
Made to compete on the... I can't say for certain that it will succeed in that, but that's definitely what they're going for.
Right.
And based on the amount of time and money they're throwing into the show, and CBS is spending a lot of money on this show. They're confident.
Right.
They're very confident. And they could be wrong. They could be... This could be a failure, but I'm... If I had to make a guess right now, I think that, yeah, this show will be closer to premium level quality mm-hmm. than it will be to, like, you know, typical CBS network quality.
Right. I think so, too. That part is pretty purely speculative, you know, as to whether they can pull off their jobs. We just haven't seen enough clips and things left us yet to say that, but I suspect that it's also going... I think that's the case, too.
Interesting that they bring up Game of Thrones, because we've mentioned Game of Thrones on the show several times.
Right.
And we'll have a link to that Kurtzman interview with Collider, but writers Ted Sullivan and Kristen Baer were talking to fans on Twitter, answering questions, and they also brought up Game of Thrones. So Ted Sullivan was asked on Twitter... Okay, so let's not get you into trouble and do a broader question. Will the show resemble Game of Thrones in the scope of its storytelling? To which he replied, I've done big shows like Supergirl. I thought I was prepared. I am constantly stunned. We go pound for pound with GOT.
That's a bold claim.
It is a bold claim, but that's what I want to hear.
Definitely, like,
I want boldness.
They're going to have to back it up, ultimately, obviously, but they are certainly throwing the big concepts out there. That's interesting. I had not seen this either. And I will say, Supergirl has is a good show, and it has it sort of has a serial story format storytelling. It's interesting to, like, I think it's well done. It does show some, you know, it showed some budgetary limitations sometimes, but I think they did a very good job with what they had before it jumped networks. But for him to say that that he thought he was prepared for Star Trek with that, and he was, like, in no way correct, does suggest a rather quantum leap forward, mm-hmm. At least in scope. We'll see, of course, if quality follows.
Yeah, and, you know, they answered a few different questions, him and Kristen Baer. They talked about, like, you know, their favorite ships, favorite bad guys in Star Trek. Ted Sullivan did mention that Jason Isaacs is delivering some impressive performances. He said that Doug Jones is doing a little bit of comedy. He said there is some funny stuff.
Who's Doug Jones in it?
He's going to be Saru. He's the weird, tall, skinny guy.
The alien?
Yeah.
All right. And Doug Jones, Jason Isaacs, of course, is going to be the captain of the Discovery. He's a pretty commanding actor, and I like the notion of him getting a meaty role.
One thing that Sullivan did say about Kristen Baer, she is keeper of flame, defender of canon, perfect mix of character and theme. We're all fans, but she's the Ambassador Sarek of the Star Trek room. The main thing I take away from that is the defender of canon.
Mm-hmm.
So people that are worried about, like, the show, it looks like it's not going to fit into the continuity. And I'm with you. I'm a big continuity freak when it comes to Star Trek. And I love to try to find ways to make it all fit together in my head canon.
Marvel No Prize style.
Yeah. But I love that I'm hearing this. It sounds like, you know, they're definitely aware that this is an important issue and that they are going to have that in mind as they're writing.
Right. If they're going to tout that somebody is holding their feet to the flame on it, then I would certainly hope that they mean it.
And he went on to say that they're using Memory Alpha to get little details right. And he said that, you know, they're all big nerdy fans.
That's cool. Memory Alpha is, like, an insanely good resource. Just the sheer amount of detail there when I look up an episode is amazing.
Yeah, you know, growing up, I always read the Star Trek Encyclopedia that Michael and Denise Okuda put out. And, I had a bunch of nights as a kid where I would, you know, fall asleep with the Star Trek Encyclopedia, like, on my chest because I stayed up all night reading it. And yeah, now that we have Memory Alpha online, it's great to have access to all the lore and
right, and probably like constantly edited, like Wikipedia adds new stuff to be added in there. They could do an episode of Discovery that in some way touches on some episode of Next Generation or something like that, and that will go and become part of that episode's entry on, you know, the next day.
So if you're outside of the U.S. or Canada, stay off of Memory Alpha on the 24th. Wait till Monday the 25th when you can watch the show on Netflix, because there's probably going to be some spoilers.
Yeah,
learn
about it. There will be material. There will be a blow-for-blow account of the episode.
Yeah, don't look up anything on Memory Alpha, because it'll be on there if some new information that ties into that page shows up on the show. Sullivan was also asked, as conflict is the best way to get drama into the story, can we expect some drama on the bridge? And Sullivan replied, drama can be defined in so many ways. There will be edge of seat drama, moral dilemma, political drama, why limit? The show goes there. So this sounds like there might be a little bit of, you know, people talk about drama and conflict in Star Trek a lot. This might be some conflict between characters on the show and the crew. And this went on to, this kind of ties into an EW, Entertainment Weekly, interview with showrunners Aaron Herberts and Gretchen Berg. When they were asked about what the EW called Roddenberry's role. EW asked them, writers on the previous shows used to struggle under creator Gene Roddenberry's utopian rules, like crew members must not have major conflicts with each other or be put in a bad light. Are you held to those restrictions as well? And showrunner Aaron Herberts replied, we're trying to do stories that are complicated, with characters with strong points of view and strong passions. People have to make mistakes. Mistakes are still going to be made in the future. The thing we're taking from Roddenberry is how we solve those conflicts. So we do have our characters in conflict. We do have them struggling with each other. But it's about how they find a solution and work through their problems. People have been making a big deal about this online. Dave, what do you think about it?
You know, as a very quick, my gut reaction is, I'm happy to hear him say that. I always felt like as an old school Trek fan who resisted Next Gen at times, I always felt that they were a little too cozy. even though, interestingly, Picard's distance from the crew was also a major show arc for like its entire run. That and there was even like conflicts in the first episode that like he and Riker were like butting heads and stuff. No. In there,
who let this kid on my bridge?
Yeah. But broadly speaking, I didn't feel like I got the fireworks that I did in the original show. It sounds like they're promising fireworks. I'm happy to hear it. I don't think they're going to abandon his broad utopian vision and have these guys like constantly fighting. I mean, even Babylon 5, which to me was a breath of fresh air at the time from Next Generation, still had broad cooperation among their guys. It's just that you didn't know for sure if there might be, there could be major, major points of contention between lead characters at times on Babylon 5.
And my big takeaway from this, you know, Pete, this wasn't like the showrunners went out and said, we're abandoning Roddenberry's rule. They were asked.
It's been read that way, though.
Yeah, like they were asked specifically, and the way that they were asked, you know, we have this idea of Roddenberry's utopia, crew members have no major conflicts with each other. Are you held to those restrictions? And they said, no. But what they should have said, I think, is that no show was held to those restrictions. Some people might get mad or disagree with this, but those restrictions do not exist in Star Trek. There has never been a single season of any Star Trek show where all the characters got along all the time. You know, like you said, there is always a sense of cooperation, mm-hmm. but people did disagree and butt heads, and the big Star Trek element, this utopian, idealistic future, was when they could work through their differences and find solutions, which is exactly what these showrunners said they're doing. So to me, when I read this, this is the...
You felt like it was too leading a question, kind of like, Obviously, this is a problem, right? And they're like, well, yeah, we want drama.
Well, the way that they answered it, it sounded like, no, they're actually following Roddenberry's vision.
Right. To show that they're sort of pushing through on conflicts.
Right. Yeah. And you know, if you think that this sounds, you know, anti-Star Trek, if you think this is just Trek heresy, think about, like, Bones and Spock on the original series. They butted heads quite a bit. We had a racist on the episode The Balance of Terror,
right,
who hated Spock because he looked like a Romulan,
right,
and that was some major conflict between characters on that show. You could make the argument that humans, you know, were supposed to be a little bit more evolved later in the 24th century on Next Generation. Well, this show takes place closer to the, you know, actually before the original series. So, you know, if that's your argument, I think that's kind of trumped. The idea that on the Next Generation that characters always got along on that show, you know, that's not true. There were conflict between characters all the time. Commander Shelby coming on board the Enterprise had some major conflicts with Riker in The Best of Both Worlds, Parts 1 and 2. Jellicoe from the Chain of Command, when he was put in command of the Enterprise, him and Riker butted heads.
Now, these are external characters, not core bridge crew.
Core bridge crew. We'll even go back to the second season when Roddenberry was more involved.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Pulaski and Data. There is a conflict there. She had some issues with
him. She seemed to, she was kind of that perspective that he was, like, essentially a tool. A soulless tool, it seems like, when she first
appeared. Yeah, and he said, like, no, I'm an individual. And that was a conflict.
And she's like, shut up your data.
I think
people, the sense is more just that it didn't rise to the kind of heightened drama of, you know, McCoy yelling at, you know, they had Data and I would say, Pulaski, did you say Pulaski?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Dan and Pulaski had a sort of polite conversation that was like slightly elevated voices. I think it's sort of just the passion of McCoy losing it on Spock, and Kirk is also getting kind of rather passionate in his discussions that I think I missed, and that I think some people missed in Next Gen.
But
I agree with your general thesis. That Next Generation was not like this conflict free utopia.
Yeah, I haven't even gotten into Worf and all the objections he has.
Poor Worf got
shut
down all the time. I felt bad about that, honestly. But yeah, I feel like it kind of entered the Trek consciousness. That's criticism early on. I don't know if writers have said that they bristled under his restrictions.
Writers have said that, but we also have to keep in mind, and I'm sorry if
you're about to say that writers are liars.
No, I'm sorry if this offends anybody. But yeah, Roddenberry was making a bunch of weird choices in the first couple seasons of Next Generation. He would make some strange rulings on, you can do this, you can't do this. This is also when he was older, and before the show started, he had supposedly spent a little time in rehab. He was in bad health.
Mm-hmm.
He's probably not the best guy at that point to be setting all the rules on Star Trek.
You don't think he was at his creative peak, maybe?
And I love Roddenberry. I love what he created with Star Trek. I believe in the Roddenberry philosophy. I think we should aspire to this utopian, egalitarian, post-capitalist future that he conceived. I love that. That's Star Trek's been a major impact on how I view the world, and it's because of like the Roddenberry philosophy that I connected with early on. I love the man, and I'm thankful for that. But yeah, he was making some weird choices. If you go in and read interviews with what these writers are told they could do and couldn't do, they're inconsistent as hell.
Have I ever mentioned on this podcast I'm going to use a little parrot. A parable with Peanuts and Charles Schulz?
I don't think so.
Just real quick, Charles Schulz, the original Peanuts comic strips are rather very steeped in sarcasm and sort of a dry, kind of even kind of cruel humor at times. If you've ever seen the first comic, you know, Peanuts ever, there's like a little kid sitting on a street corner, and Charlie Brown is like walking kind of nearer to him, and he's two kids talking, and they're like, there goes Charlie Brown. Next panel. Charlie Brown's a little bit closer. And he's like, they're like, good old Charlie Brown. Charlie Brown passes them. Final panel, he's a little ways off. And they look and the kid's like, how I hate him. That was kind of its jaundiced view. Later on, in his older years, I read an interview with him, and he said he kind of regretted all that stuff. And then this was, by the way, at a time when Peanuts had been really lame for like a decade or more. Kind of real trite, soft humor. Like, all of the teeth that it had in the early days had been gone for a long time. Mm-hmm. And he had created characters like Joe Grunge in the 90s, had Snoopy and wearing a flannel shirt. To mind the grunge popularity. Anyway, he said that he regretted some of those strips. He, like, wished the characters had been nicer to each other. I think he'd kind of become more religious than he had been before. And he sort of felt like, why couldn't I have been nicer and taught better lessons and stuff like that? And I think, he was so clearly a different person at that point. He was an older guy reflecting back and who just kind of wanted people to be nicer in the world. But he couldn't view his work sort of objectively and see how potent that sarcasm was. Like, at a time, I think, when America kind of needed, some kids who were fucking smartasses and not just lovable urchins, who were actually kind of felt like they had some character to them. So it sounds like, like Roddenberry, it's like people change. A few decades will change you. I'm sure he somewhat bought into his own hype and got a little bit, I gather, was he always egotistical?
Probably.
I mean, that's a lot of creators are. I don't even say that in necessarily a negative way. It's kind of how shit gets done sometimes.
Yeah, for sure.
He probably was a little bit like Schultz, thinking, he would get a notion and would kind of run with it. And he was like, I'm the boss. I created this massive empire that changed how people like Fathery think in their life, so you better listen to me.
Yeah, and just the only time that the writers talk about, being super restricted was on those first couple of seasons on The Next Generation. I think after that, people still kind of held this idea of, humans will be more evolved, we'll have we wouldn't have the same level of conflict between each other that we have now, but there'll still be some. People will have different opinions, and you see that carried out in shows like Deep Space Nine and Voyager. On Voyager, you can make the argument about you have like the Maquis people and the Starfleet people, mm-hmm. and I guess a good Starfleet person is going to be like the pure, Roddenberry character, and like they'll always get along.
Right.
But that doesn't happen on there. There's conflicts between Janeway and Tuvok. Mm-hmm. When I actually love the scene when Tuvok disobeyed Janeway's orders, mm-hmm. and helped some other crew members try to obtain technology that will get them home quicker.
Mm-hmm.
And when she is chewing his ass out about it, and he says, it was the logical thing to do. I love what Janeway's response when she says, you can twist logic and make it support damn near anything. That is the strength and the weakness to it. And I just loved a character saying that to a Vulcan.
Yeah, yeah.
And it harkens back to, that kind of sounds like something that maybe Bones should have told Spock on the original series.
Right.
And if you
it's
look
at
that, it's
a way of saying your whole moral philosophy might be screwed up.
Yeah, and then just, like, the whole, like, asking questions or, like, debating something like that, that's Star Trek-y as hell. That's Star Trek in a nutshell. So if you're taking that kind of approach to Star Trek Discovery, right on, brother. That sounds like you're doing it right. Mm-hmm. So I'm happy with their response to this question from EW.
You know what, we talk about the utopian future, and Picard. I remember in like for original Star Trek, he kind of told Q like we've evolved past, our need for selfishness, and I think also like did he say for tangible like sort of physical goods or something like that? Did he? There's some suggestion of like, or maybe it was just talking about money. I know that they sometimes play it cagey, and they're not necessarily wildly consistent about this. But is there money in Next Generation? I know that like obviously because the what do you call it Quark
Well, for sure on Earth, there's not money.
Right.
There might be in other parts of the Federation.
Right.
But yeah, I mean,
and it's... And they obviously have to find some way to deal with what for the Ferengi and things like that that very clearly have money. What I was going to say is, what I would like to see in this, and maybe a little more of in every show, is some things that we would think of in our present times as still a little out there, but would be a presumed fact of life in their world. So we're talking about different sexual politics, talking about, like, to some degree they did this, but, like, you know, we only just got to gay marriage, right? We're just hitting it. It's still contentious, even, in America. It should be, you know, that would be the standard that they would have been so used to for generations of in Next Generation or in Star Trek, that there should just be zero question about it from anybody in the Federation. And if I would like to see, like, something like that, but I mean, anything that we think of, everybody is presumably has some environmental awareness. Is everybody vegetarian? You know, are all the foods made? You know, are all the everything is, I guess, replicated at that point.
Yeah.
But whatever we think of, things that are very contentious now, but would be the moral thing and the righteous sort of thing to do, I'd like to just see casual conversations in Star Trek that indicate, yep, that's just the norm. That's just how they live. I just kind of want to see that, more of that, plus aliens.
No, yeah, I agree. Moving on, Entertainment Weekly also spoke to the showrunners about the delays on the show. Aaron Harberts told them, "These things have to be designed and manufactured. We flew a costume designer to Switzerland to pick up the fabric for the Starfleet uniforms. Several items on our uniforms are 3D printed. Some of our sets take over 6 weeks to make. CBS has given us the time and the money to make something the fans will find worthwhile." Gretchen Berg added, "You can't cut corners or have 95% of what's on screen be completely original and inspired, and then have 5% something you bought at a store. It has to be cohesive. And it is. I'm so proud of what's on screen. It's so beautiful, and it takes world building to a whole new level."
So, what I interpret out of this is, shut up about the delays. again, it's like, they're talking a good game. Well, that's what I want to hear is, if it's delayed, it's because we want to make it the best it can be. All of this always ultimately has to come down to, do they pull it off? But that's what I want to hear.
Yeah, and, you know, this just backs up.
I guess they wouldn't say, we're just in the back smoking dope.
But no, like, this really backs up, you know, what I've been saying about, like, you know, about the delays, is these shows distributed like this are allowed the freedom to take their time. That's part of why we tend to see better quality on things like, not just on Netflix and streaming services, but also, you know, I think HBO might have a little bit more freedom. Going back to Game of Thrones again, they wanted to wait a little bit longer to shoot the most recent season that's about to premiere. They wanted to shoot it in winter, mm-hmm. and get a more winterish look.
Right.
And they were allowed the freedom to do that, because it's not like, oh, well, you have to do 22 episodes a year from the fall to the spring. Mm-hmm. And so these premium shows are allowed the freedom to kind of play with the air date or the release date. And Star Trek Discovery has capitalized on that opportunity.
I think there's probably... I don't know that I've, like, looked into the specific fan complaints, but I imagine there's, to some degree, a sense of, well, if previous Treks, which I love, did, you know, were ran on a tighter schedule and sometimes had to accept cutting corners, then damn it, the new ones should be able to do it, too. What do they think, they're better than us? You know, I think there is probably a little bit of that old school kind of get off my lawn, stop being prima donnas, and just... fucking make the show.
That's a silly argument.
I tend to agree.
No, I want it to be treated with care. I want it to be the best possible product it can be.
What if they said it'll take 5 more years to get it that shape? Within reason, is what you're saying.
Yeah, that would be a bit ridiculous. But I was okay to
I just had to quick devil's advocate for no reason.
I was okay to wait 5 extra months. I don't know about 5 extra years.
5 years and you burn the place down.
They talked to Entertainment Weekly about some of the influences on the show. Gretchenberg said, there's a hint of all of them, referring to the previous Trek shows.
Right.
But in the writer's room, people are so in love with the original series and Next Generation, and they talk about the family aspect of those cast members. Aaron Harberts added, I think Nicholas Meyer's film are a touchstone, and not just because he's been on staff with us. His storytelling is complex and intellectual, and yet there's a lot of room for character voices and character work. He's done such an incredible job with the franchise. So what do you think about this?
The you know, I like hearing him talk about that family aspect of the cast members. I assume that, I don't know if they're specifically talking about how they relate to each other or how they as viewers felt that, like, they were almost like part of their family. Or, like, you think of Data as family, you know, you think of Geordi as family, you think of, you know, McCoy as, you know, like somebody you could talk to and hang out with. Or was it the way those characters got along specifically? I can't quite tell from that. I like both of those ideas.
My interpretation is that, you know, like, the way that the ensemble relates to each other,
mm-hmm.
and that they're kind of like a family unit.
Right.
I'm not surprised that people in the writer's room seem to love the original series and Next Generation, because those are the two most popular Star Trek shows.
Yeah.
And they both kind of had, like, that, I guess the other shows had it too, but I mean, it's really apparent that, yeah, like these people, you know, they work together, they get along, they can accomplish great feats. Mm-hmm. Kind of the whole, the whole is greater than the, what is it? The sum of
the whole is greater than the sum of the parts.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You
know, you talked about how, like to break away from some, one of the ones they mentioned, how on DS9, how you felt like a sort of yearning for that Sisko and Jake's relationship, father son thing. I feel like, yeah, there's, Star Trek has always had a certain comforting quality in the way the characters interact, where I'm like, man, I wish I was there with them. You know? I'm like, these guys stand up against injustices, they might fight amongst themselves, but they work that shit out, and there's a bond there. You know, of course, they also are all, like, every one of them is kind of, like, the best there is at whatever their focus is, except for Barkley. and so there's also that you know, that kind of classic sort of, like, you know, any sort of military mission movie does that in you, you know. So there's a certain kind of, I guess, military bonding, even though they're not highly military in Trek, or in their presentation of it. But yeah,
but they're throwing out the Roddenberry philosophy, and everyone's gonna not get along, and won't work together as a team, or, you know, whatever the criticism is.
I think that the imagining is that, like, the first officer's gonna say one thing the captain doesn't like, and just get punched in the face right there in the first episode. Get off my bridge.
Yeah, no, that, if that's what you're worried about, calm down. That is not what we're getting into.
I like what they say about Myers, the balance he finds. They say, complex and intellectual, there's a lot of room for character voices and character work. Because I do feel that that's a hallmark of all of his movies that I've seen, is that I feel like those actors probably really enjoyed the scenes that they did. Their lines were very meaningful. You know, they had, like, heart to those scenes and pathos. And I feel like, you know, if that is his influence on it, I really like that idea.
Was that a hallmark of Time After Time?
Time After Time,
I never saw it.
I've seen it. Time After Time, I remember, as being kind of a sweet movie. You know, it was like a fish-out-of-water time travel story about a kind of a, you know, a dusty H.G. Wells. And then there was this kind of, like, driving it forward was the suspense plot about Jack the Ripper in the present day. But it was also kind of about this guy, a man out of time, falling for a modern-day girl who, of course, had her modern-day, then, like, modern-day 1980 morals or whatever. Like, what? You can just have sex with people? as I do recall, that there was a lot of character, you know, like, character room. It had a strong plot, which was stop Jack the Ripper, must track him down. But there was, you know, you could argue that, yeah, it was kind of Myers-ish in the sense that it was also a love story that was kind of a sweet love story, as I recall. It's been a long time since I've seen it.
But I love the idea of taking, like, the Nicholas Meyer kind of approach to character, you know, character work, character voices, and marrying that with elements from the original series and Next Generation. Mm-hmm. Sounds like a Star Trek show I want to watch.
Yeah, me too.
Possibly another influence again, going to bring up Game of Thrones.
Is this the one that made everybody freak?
Some fans, I guess, freaked out about this, but Berg also told Entertainment Weekly, Game of Thrones changed television. They almost made it difficult to fall in love with people because you didn't know if they were going to be taken away from you. That show's had an influence on all TV dramas that have come after it. And, it sounds like they might be a little bit more eager to kill off some characters.
Although, looking at that full quote, in a way, his thing, he mentioned that...
This is Gretchen Berg.
They didn't outright say they were going to be mimicking that. They just said it changed television.
Yeah.
And then she said it's had an influence on all TV dramas that have come after it. Now, that might have just been her kind of cautiously sidestepping it. I half wondered if that was just because, you and I have surmised that maybe Michelle Yeoh or Jason Isaac or somebody like that, they might die in the first episode or that first two-parter, and that might be the big dramatic shakeup. And this is just kind of a way of, almost preparing people that, hey, there's going to be a major surprise death. But it may be more meaningful because, Trek has dealt with death before. We have seen Yar. We have seen, over the course of the movies, we've seen Spock die and come back.
Pretty much every show has lost at least one regular person.
Because this one is the first one, I feel like Deep Space Nine probably, and Voyager arguably, and maybe even Enterprise, had more serial aspects to them. Like, that is to say, more greater continuity mythology. Mm-hmm. This one, though, specifically feels like they want to zero in on characters as they change and grow. And if that's the case, then there will be a particular weight that, although they brought up Yar's death at times, it didn't impact the show directly. It impacted, I think, the viewers, how they saw the show. But it didn't impact the show directly, except on those occasional episodes where they would kind of remember Yar, or mm-hmm. her sister would show up, or something like that. But here, I think, it sounds like they may be wanting to say that, if they're going to lose somebody, it will have a weight that will run through these characters' lives, and, the very next episode could be dramatically changed because of losing somebody.
Yeah, and why were people upset about this this quote from
Entertainment Weekly? I think they think that there's going to be the level of killing that Game of Thrones did. I think that was part of the worry. And there is, when we're talking about that family aspect of Trek, that kind of sense of the crew as family, you will lose some of that comfortableness if there's anything more than the occasional loss of a crew member. That could be threatened a little bit. It might be interesting. I'm not saying it would be dramatically bad. I'm always kind of interested to see what, different alchemies of drama and how they work out. But it would mean potentially the loss of that sort of feeling of, that safety, and every week I go and I hang out with Picard and Riker and Geordi and Troy and my friends. It'd be like, oh, except for Geordi, who died horribly. it could mess it up a little bit. I think that's what people, I tend to think that this is most upsetting to people who are already somewhat predisposed to feel like this show is kind of has gone off the rails. Maybe because of the 2009 Trek effect. But I would have some concern if they had Game of Thrones level deaths.
Yeah, but I think that's kind of hard to extrapolate that based off of what she said.
And more than anything, it sounds like she was just saying that we're going to think about these things differently, and that, maybe it changes how TV depicts death. You don't want Yar to die, and the next episode is another story of the week. You need it to be something that's dealing with her.
Yeah, but, they've said all along this will be a more serialized show. Typically with that approach, things will have consequence. And, if a character does die, it'll be part of, a planned arc, and then we'll see, the fallout of that death mm-hmm. or something like that, which, that's good television, in my opinion. When Star Trek has done serialization before, some on Deep Space Nine, watch the first six episodes of season six, or the last 10 episodes of season seven, where they kind of had like this long arc. You know, it works pretty well, and I don't want a show where every episode they just reset back to the status quo. And, you know, like having, sometimes you might lose someone and then you have to deal with the fallout of that, would lend itself to that serialized storytelling that they're talking about doing. The showrunners also spoke to Entertainment Weekly about the characters Sarek and Burnham, our main character, played by Sonequa Martin-Green.
Michael Burnham.
Aaron Harbert said, "Sarek plays an important role in her life, which has been completely planned until she makes a very difficult choice that sends her life on a very different path. When we meet her, she's the first officer of the starship Senzu. And Burnham's choice that we're alluding to is the most difficult choice you can make. It affects her, it affects Starfleet, affects the Federation, it affects the entire universe. The choice leads her to a different ship, the USS Discovery, and there we begin what Gretchen Berg and I call our second pilot."
That is an interesting amount of weight to put on whatever her choice is.
It's going to affect the universe. Is that going to create another timeline?
I mean, you know, like, if...
That'll be the niche Nicholas Meyer mentioned, where they fit into the chronology, their own time stream.
You know, it'd be interesting to know, like the way they talk about the import of her decision, it almost sounds like one of those things where, like, if you found out that, say, if she stayed on the Shenzhou, that... she would lead an amazing life of discovery, but some crucial thing that she would make, this is sort of the Kirk City on the Edge of Forever thing. She would be happy, but like the universe gets destroyed, some domino is flipped somewhere, and the universe falls apart. Or she could go to the Discovery, where she's destined to take some role in saving the universe, but she will die an early death, or, you know, or something horrible will happen. Some kind of terrible, like, Sophie's Choice like that is makes it sound like that's what's happening. And you could do that with time travel stuff. I hope they don't. I don't want to see more time travel stuff.
Well,
but I mean, that's... The way they phrase it is interestingly big.
I'm thinking that I mean, we already know some of this from the trailer. Now, the show will start with Commander Burnham as the first officer on the Shenzhou, under, Captain, I think her name is going to be pronounced Georgiou. And I think whatever her choice is, you know, my theory has been for a while that the Shenzhou will be destroyed. I think Burnham, Saru, maybe one or two other characters survive, but we'll lose our Captain Georgiou for sure. And it'll be Burnham's fault because of something that she did, because of some action she took. Mm-hmm. It might be that, you know, we know that they're going to find some Klingon object in space. In the trailer, we have, you know, characters mentioning we have an object of unknown origin.
Right.
We need to go and explore it, see what it is.
Could be something those Klingons from the sarcophagus ship are like, don't you dare touch that.
And I think whatever she does, it'll have, you know, maybe because they do go and stick their nose where it doesn't belong, and there's major ramifications for it. We also see in the trailer she's having some conflict with Captain Georgiou about, you know, Starfleet doesn't fire first, but, you know, this time it needs to.
Right.
And maybe because...
You think that could be the mistake she makes?
Yeah, and, you know, she makes a choice, it turns out to be the wrong choice, and there's major fallout from it.
I think you're probably right about that. That what little we have seen in the trailers does back that up. I could see that they would want to hint at that, but not show so much that people are able to extrapolate easily what that means. But that does sound like it would certainly fit.
And what we were also told about, like, her having this connection with Sarek, it sounds like he might have raised her. We know that the character is going to be from a human from the planet Vulcan. And I don't know if, like, maybe Sarek helped raise this human girl or something. And, you know, the dialogue in the trailer sounds like he might be a little hard on her. You know, you're too human.
Yep.
And it might be because she has a chip on her shoulder and she's trying to overcome her human emotions And because of that overcompensation, she makes the wrong choice. There's right. major consequence.
Yeah. I'm really interested in the sort of the Vulcan struggle and stuff in this. I think that will be interesting. A human who is that close to Vulcan philosophy definitely has all sorts of interesting potential for dramatic...
Yeah, it's a neat idea.
...dramatic doings.
I'm kind of surprised no one's ever thought about doing that because, you know, Spock has been around from the very beginning. From the original pilot.
I'm sure that he casts a long shadow. You don't want to be a half-assed Spock, you know?
But this is, you're not doing the same thing. You're putting a different twist on it that makes it your own thing. And I think it's really interesting. It's kind of like the anti-Spock or the opposite mm-hmm. Spock. You have this human trying to be a Vulcan.
Yeah, it's an interesting possibility that she might be able to... I don't know if I'm getting ahead of the stuff you discussed in there, but the notion that she might be able to kind of plug into that Vulcan side, like when she needs to be unemotional, she can be unemotional. That's an interesting notion to be able to turn off what usually like what Data always wanted to turn on. He's like, I would like to be able to be more human, and she's like, I would like to be able to be more Vulcan.
Well, we did learn some more about Commander Burnham. Aaron Harberts told Entertainment Weekly, "The advantage of her not being in charge of the bridge right now is we get to tell stories from a very different point of view. It's a fresh feeling because we're not on the bridge all the time. We get access to more parts of the ship." So I got an idea about this also. Brian Fuller said early on, when he was still involved in the show, that the main character won't be the captain. It was going to be a lieutenant commander with caveats. And so I'm kind of thinking that maybe she has the rank of commander. She's the first officer. We know that for sure. We know that Captain Georgiou is talking to her about, you know, maybe it's time you get your own command.
Yep.
I think that after this happens, she might get in trouble with Starfleet, get demoted from commander to lieutenant commander.
Mm-hmm.
And some of those caveats that Brian Fuller mentioned come into play. And, if she's not the first officer, maybe she has, like, some other role on the ship. Maybe she's working in engineering or something. Maybe she's part of, like, the security team or something. And she's, you know, not always on the bridge.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to see Discovery possibly, over the course of a few seasons, if this is what happens, have her, you know, rise back through the ranks and then end up being a captain eventually.
I'd really like to see, you know, I always like, I kind of like the handheld camera stuff sometimes, on the West Wing was the described as sort of the style of the show, the mm-hmm. walk and talk thing, camera kind of closely tracking people through quarters of the bridge, long Martin Scorsese-esque tracking shots. I don't know if they're specifically going to mind that, but I like the idea of, you know, seeing her like, okay, I need to get some stuff done for the captain. How does she go about it? I want to, like, watch her. I want the camera to follow her down below decks, down a few corridors, left and right, up and down through some turbo lifts, and get shit done. I kind of want to get that sense of...
That's how J.J. Abrams wrote shot the Kelvin movies.
It's true, except they were running on all of those.
Yeah, so this will be, instead of a run and talk, this is a walk and talk.
That's right. Yes, okay. I do want them to get more, I think, talking and less giant puffy Kirk hands moments going on.
Agreed.
But yes, I think you could have, there's a lot to potentially be mined in sort of showing, you know, a character that could reveal the inner workings of the ship in a way that's a little harder to do through, even though it's very convenient, to show a bridge where kind of like you just issue orders and it happens.
Yeah. And we talked, everyone has talked about this show kind of having a more lower decks type feeling to it. And also what I should point out is that Aaron Harbert's in that quote, he said that the advantage of her not being in charge of the bridge right now.
I did notice that, yes.
That's why I'm kind of thinking this might be a planned arc that she goes through. On Deep Space Nine, at some point someone had the idea of making Captain Sisko an admiral.
Mm-hmm.
I think it might have been you know, somewhere during the Dominion War when he's going to have to command a group of ships. And I think it was Ira Stephen Bear who said, no, you can't do that. And it kind of, like, stuck with the Star Trek idea that I guess started in the original series crew movies, where the captain's chair is where it's at. Don't promote your character to admiral, because then they're a boring desk jockey and they're not in command of a ship in the heart of the action. And so they kept Sisko a captain, but I thought it would be really cool if this guy who, in the beginning of the show, he's not even a captain, he's a commander. Mm-hmm. He's going to get promoted to captain, and then to see him like get promoted to admiral.
Yeah.
I thought that would have been like a really cool arc, because all the Trek shows, they have people like, you know, stuck at the same rank for way too long.
Right, they always have to find reasons why it happens.
Yeah, like, it's so dumb that Riker, who, when we first meet him, you know, he's ready for command, and he's super career-focused. Mm-hmm. He wants to be the best captain Starfleet's ever had someday. For him to stick around and be Picard's first officer for 14 years,
yeah,
it doesn't work.
Well, it's certainly, I would say it contradicts our current understanding of how people sort of rise up through the military. But if you consider the way things might work in their time, where there would be like, you could be ambitious, but you truly could do, maybe, you know, get more done, as you know, in the way they kind of excuse it on the shows, like as a member of the Enterprise, the flagship of the fleet, the one that's done, you know, gets more first contacts, more stops Q from destroying the worlds than anything else.
Okay,
there's at least an argument to be made, I think.
What about
that? It works for him.
What about after Star Trek Generations, when the Enterprise D is destroyed, and then instead of taking a command somewhere, he just sticks around, hangs out with Picard, twiddles his thumbs, waits for them to build a new Enterprise.
Well, at that point, his spirit
so he can be first officer.
At that point,
on
his
it.
Spirit has been broken. He's like, I'm just Picard's lackey now. He's just shown as like this bitter old
but
drunk.
Then a few years after that, in Star Trek Nemesis, he's like, oh yeah, I'm gonna go command the Titan now.
Right. You know. They, as the movies draw out the timelines more and need to have dramatic things happen, you can have dramatic things happen like that, just to quick move things forward.
But in universe, I'm saying it
doesn't
work. Yeah,
in universe, it's a little dodgy.
I mean, you can excuse it, but...
What they should do is write a novel that shows what happened in that time that made him suddenly decide that the time was right now.
They probably have. Going back to Commander Burnham, we also had some quotes from the actress, Sonequa Martin-Green, in Entertainment Weekly. She said, I have an inner war, and it's a journey of self-discovery and finding out what it means to be alive, to be human, to be a Starfleet officer, what it means to be a hero. I have the Vulcan conflict in my life from Sarek and Amanda, so there's always going to be that inner conflict with me. But I think it's relatable because we all have some kind of inner conflict going on. Who we are versus who we present ourselves to be, there's a lot to be discovered.
Whoa, she tied in the name of the show to it.
I don't know if that was intentional, but good job, Sonequa. So what I think is interesting is that she points out Sarek and Amanda.
Mm-hmm.
So,
Amanda, who we've seen neither hide nor hair of, I believe, in any trailers or any discussion.
Although, a long time ago, like a year ago, I think this was actually at Comic-Con last July, Brian Fuller said he'd be really interested in having Winona Ryder on the show play Amanda Grayson. And it kind of makes sense now if we know that we have a character who was possibly raised by Sarek and Amanda. Right.
I don't like it just because... It blurs the lines weirdly between alternate timelines. I mean, I'd go ahead and just cast a different actress just so that it's very kind of clear. Kelvin timeline gets to do its own thing. And Winona Ryder can go do Stranger Things season 2. but I mean, is anything like that going to happen? I feel like it's a bit of a blurring. It wouldn't bug me in particular. I just kind of am glad they didn't.
But what do you think about Commander Burnham's relationship to Sarek and Amanda from what we're hearing?
I mean, that sounds kind of interesting. What that seems to mean is that, do we know that, like, did Sarek, like, in particular, like, tutor her in the ways? Like, do we know his precise relationship?
No.
You know, I would presume that he would not too often, I mean, take a particular interest in a particular student at the, was it like the Vulcan Science Academy?
Yes. So yeah, we know that she is the first human to attend the Vulcan Science Academy.
And that he's a prominent Vulcan guy. I could see him. Yeah. So he might in that case take an interest. And presumably, some places he's going to go, his wife will be with him. I don't know if she had a job per se.
She was a school teacher.
She was a school teacher on Vulcan?
I hadn't thought of this before, but maybe she did teach Vulcan kids, and she was.
She could be the here teacher, and Sarek will sometimes come by to pick up his wife, and he'll be like, "We need to go in the back room, kid. Get out of here."
Another idea that just a thought. I was on the YouTube channel Boat Trek recently, talking to our friend PJ, who's been very supportive of Text Trek. I was talking to him about possibilities here, and he suggested that, I think it was he that came up with this, that maybe there was an Earth ambassador to Vulcan, and so you had a human who lived on Vulcan with their spouse and kid, and that's why she was there and would go to school there.
That she was the Earth ambassador to Vulcan?
She's the kid of the Earth ambassador.
Oh, I see what you're saying, yes. That's an interesting notion. I could see that playing into the story pretty easily.
I'm thinking it could also be something where she's an orphan, and it sounds like her relationship with Sarek, she was on a path where everything was planned.
Right.
So I wonder if maybe her parents were killed, and Sarek kind of took her in, and and part of his ambassadorial role to foster relations between humans and Vulcans, he thought he would raise a human on the planet Vulcan. Mm-hmm. I guess Spock would come along somewhere in this. I don't, maybe like she was kind of like a foster sister of Spock,
right?
I don't know. It raises a lot of questions.
If they ever at any point decided to do any sort of the structuring that we associate with TV show Lost, or more recently Arrow, where you always had the island flashbacks, and you would flashback to a younger actress portraying her. I mean, she could have this kind of sibling rivalry with Spock. You could probably eke a fair amount out of that. I feel like people got a little burned out on it on Arrow, but occasional flashbacks to her past on Vulcan could actually bring out a lot of character for her.
Yeah, and we have a hint of that in the trailer. We do see a flashback to her as a kid.
It's just a question of whether that's just generally a one-off thing or something they might return to.
And I know the Enterprise pilot Broken Bow, which we'll be talking about soon in a future episode. But they did have some flashbacks in that first episode to little kid Jonathan Archer and his dad.
Yep.
And they only did it in that episode. And I don't think that was intended to be an ongoing thing. Maybe it was. I kind of felt it was just a framing device for that particular story.
They wanted to dramatize that his father had felt held back by the
Bulldogs. Yeah. And that, we might see the same kind of thing with Discovery, where they do that one time and then drop it. But yeah, I hadn't thought about what you said.
There's
about
certainly some territory. I mean, I almost feel like it'd be hard for them to not have some scenes that have an actor playing a younger Spock interacting with her. I think for writers, it's hard to resist that kind of stuff. But yeah, I don't know. That's high speculative territory.
She also commented to Entertainment Weekly on the backlash that I guess some people are upset that there's a black lady cast as the main character on Star Trek. She replied to that with, "Well, I would encourage them to key into the essence and spirit of Star Trek that has made it the legacy it is. And that's looking across the way to the person sitting in front of you and realizing you are the same, that they are not separate from you, and we are all one. That's something Star Trek has always upheld, and I completely believe that is why it's been a mainstay in society and the hearts of so many people for so many decades. I would encourage them to look past their opinions and social conditioning and key into what we're doing here, which is telling a story about humanity that will hopefully bring us all together.
I completely agree. It always is weird for me when people, that anybody could like Star Trek and like cling to racism and stuff like that, beyond the degree to which we all maybe hide from ourselves our inner fears and prejudices. Like, yes, probably everybody has something lurking in there, but people who are overt about it, I'm like, what were you getting out of Star Trek? Was it just the shooty shoot? It's crazy to me. And I have, not to undercut what she's saying, but I do think, not half of it, I think a surprising amount of that criticism might have just been trolling.
Yeah, I think there are some people who genuinely, you know, like, they're worried about, like, white genocide, and a part of it is just, like, there's this whole, like, anti-PC culture out there that people are worried, you know, things are getting too PC, things are getting too politically correct, but the thing is if you're one of those people, if those are, like, your worries, you feel like they're just, like, forcing minorities into this show for no reason. If you're genuinely a fan of Star Trek, let's just, like, stop and think about it. Like, the show has always been about diversity. The original series, yeah, you had, I guess, 5 white guys and then an Asian guy and a black lady. But every Star Trek show after that, you've had, like, 50% of the cast has not been white men.
Right.
You know, Next Generation had Picard, Riker, I guess Data should count as a white man.
Well, I was just going to say, even in the original, there was a sort of contrived rainbow to it that was still, I would say, yeah, kind of Caucasian-centric because of the times, but there's a Scotsman, there's a Russian, there's a Japanese guy. It was immediately very international, even if it was not, if it was also leaned a little white. I mean, that's right out of the gate, you know. I would say, you know, contrivedly interracial and international. And I don't necessarily say contrivedly in a bad way, because it obviously got everybody thinking about this, and there's a reason it's a landmark it was. But, yeah, they, like, went out of their way to do it.
But, and then after that, you know, all the other shows, though, you have the white men are always, like, the minority in the cast, which, I mean, that's reality. In the world, most people are not white men.
Right.
Like,
it's one of the things when I was, you know, earlier when I was talking about how I just want to see, in a sort of a future where we're supposed to be more utopian, I want to see it just as a standard. Diversity would be another one of those standards that just would be pretty unquestioned by hopefully anybody who was part of the Federation.
Yeah, and that's just like how life is. You know, you go to the bank or you go to the grocery store and you see like there's a black lady and an Asian lady that work there. Unless you're just going to freak out and just...
There are some people who are clutching their pearls.
Yeah, if that like scares
like,
you...
Yeah, if they're stop talking your crazy Asian language and please don't take my purse.
I mean,
what are they doing watching Star Trek?
Yeah, so when you're watching Star Trek, you shouldn't freak out when you see, like, a black lady and an Asian lady on the show. I mean, sometimes people are a black woman or an Asian woman. I mean, that's just reality. No, and it's not like they're trying to take white people out of Star... Deep Space Nine had one white primary character, unless you want to count Odo or Quark as white men.
Right.
Yeah, Deep Space Nine had one white man primary character with Miles O'Brien.
Right.
I guess Voyager had 2 with the Doctor and Tom.
Was he Irish?
Yeah.
Well, yeah. So that makes him, like, super white. He's, like, the pastiest of the pasty.
A blonde, curly hair.
But, yeah, I mean, for God's sake, get over that. If anybody who actually believes that, go watch something else. For fuck's sake.
And we, Entertainment Weekly also had some pictures of... Sonequa Martin-Green as Commander Burnham and Michelle Yeoh as Captain Georgiou. They had a picture, the first look we've had of Captain Gabriel Lorca, the captain of the Discovery. And here, you can calm down now, he's a white man, so. You know what's going to happen is Captain Georgiou will die in the first part of the episode, or the first part of the two-parter?
Yeah.
And then in the second part, you'll have white guy Captain Lorca come in.
Yeah.
And all the trolls on the internet are going to say, see, they figured out we didn't want a non-white man captain, so they killed her off and then gave us what we wanted.
You know, I do have this feeling because they've mentioned specifically, you know, we know the Discovery is a science ship, and they've mentioned specifically his military background, that they could villain it up through him. Certainly, yeah. He's played lots of villains before. And even as I look at this shot of him, he has that slightly, even though he's not even actively doing it, a sort of what I would think of as a sneering British, could be an admiral for the Empire in Star Wars kind of look on his face.
Yeah, he's been described as a steely Federation starship captain who's considered a brilliant military tactician.
I did always actually kind of like, by the way, the jerky dude Jellico. I kind of liked him.
Yeah.
I think there would be interesting fireworks to have somebody who is a kind of a little bit more like what Worf was, you know, when he got shut down all the time in those early seasons. A kind of a military-minded guy, but who kind of military bit with a bit more tact and nuance. And that would actually be kind of interesting to me. I sort of expect that he could end up getting killed, pushing the Klingons into some state of that sets up the whole season. But I wouldn't mind seeing it if he was just an interestingly KG Jellicoe-esque captain.
He could end up being Garth of Izar.
Do we think this is a possibility?
Who knows at this point.
Remind me, the gist of Garth of Izar, he was
the commander at the Battle of Axanar, and then he went crazy and had to go into the nut house.
Right.
And then,
did he escape, or what was...
Well, no, he took over.
He took over, right.
We also had a look of Jason Isaacs getting his, like, a face masking thing done. He posted it on Twitter.
Oh, that's Jason Isaacs?
Yeah.
I thought that was like some sort of alien makeup applied to somebody.
It looks like it could be alien makeup, so one thing...
But it also looks like green screen color.
Yeah, and I don't... It could just be something like they need like a facial mold for like an action figure they're gonna make. I know Sometimes they do stuff like that. Although I think now they can probably cover most of that with like the 3D scanning technology. Right.
Or it could be something where, as part of the storyline, his consciousness gets digitally uploaded to a supercomputer, and they have to have something that will, like a giant Wizard of Oz head, and that this is him doing some sort of green screen mocap work.
I hadn't thought about that, but...
I'm just saying, brace yourself for a giant Wizard of Oz Jason Isaacs head.
It could just be something like he got infected by something and it made his face weird.
Yeah.
Or it could be that he's actually secretly a Klingon.
Yeah, like a sleeper agent or something like that.
Well, we know that they did that. Because in The Trouble with Tribbles, they had a guy altered to look human.
That's an interesting notion.
And then the...
I'm going to run with this as a headcanon until otherwise proven that he is a stealth Klingon.
Yeah, just watch the show.
Brilliant military tactician. Sounds Klingon-ish.
You know, I never thought about this before, but... Since there is a precedence for having Klingons disguised as humans and implanted in the Federation, they could kind of do like a Battlestar Galactica thing of like who's a Cylon, like who's a Klingon.
Yeah,
they had an opportunity to do that on Deep Space Nine with the changelings, the shapeshifters, and they messed around with that a little bit on the show, but I always felt like they could have had more fun with that and done it more.
Right, I feel like it's. Because Galactica made, you know, really leaned into that one.
It's kind of played out.
I don't think I'd want it done too much, but, you know, if there was, you know, if they found out at some point that there's three infiltrators on the ship or something, and, like, for a few episodes or part of a season, they have to try and figure this out, I could be down for it. I think they'd probably shy away from it, though, just, yeah, they don't want to get...
We've been there, done that.
Yeah.
The last thing we're going to talk about, Jonathan Frakes... who we all know as Commander Riker, will be directing at least one episode the first season of Star Trek Discovery, which makes a lot of sense. He's worked on various Star Trek shows. He directs a lot of TV now.
Did he direct one or more of the movies?
Yeah, he did First Contact and Insurrection. So he did one good movie and one not-so-good movie.
Yep.
But that might have been script issues.
And he did a damn good job on First Contact.
Yeah. I'm not really surprised by this, especially taking into account that he worked on the TV show Roswell, which was also ran by Aaron Harberts and Gretchen Berg. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he's worked with them before. But I'm kind of thrilled about this because we know he's going to be working on the Seth MacFarlane show, The Orville,
right.
which neither one of us are too excited about.
Yeah.
Just because I think, is it fair to say, like, that's the type of comedy you don't really enjoy? That's my approach to it. I don't like MacFarlane's humor.
I actually would say that I've liked Family Guy at times. I can buy into Family Guy.
Oh, fuck you.
Where's your sense of Star Trek camaraderie? Where's your infinite diversity and infinite combinations? That includes humor.
I guess.
Okay? but you just had to go all Worf there. No, I can buy into him sometimes. His movies, like, was it Ted and whatever that Western was? Those, even the trailers, like, I felt like where you're putting your best material in trailers, and I couldn't get a laugh, and I felt like there was a lot of sort of recycled style from Family Guy. I've generally kind of written him off. I'm kind of, like, done with his sense of humor. He has a thing that he does. I think he can do it pretty well, but I'm not really looking forward to the Orville, because I think, even if it's, I don't know, it didn't make me laugh on the trailer, and it didn't look like it had enough heart to match Galaxy Quest or enough smarts to match Star Trek, so I feel like it's going to be this kind of bastard
song. Although he did say that Star Trek, I'm sorry, that the Orville was kind of misrepresented in the trailer. He said that it's going to
was
be...
That, what's his name said that?
Yeah, he said it's closer to Star Trek than it is Futurama. That it's going to be an hour-long dramedy, and it'll be kind of serious at times and kind
so
of
so they might have just opened with the kind of all the comedic stuff. I mean, like, it's really Family Guy-ish. That thing where they're telling the alien that they're talking to on the screen, you know, on the view screen, clearly during this moment when he's just said his big speech, they're like, could you just shift a little to the left? You're kind of off-center. And, like, I don't know how you're going to have drama in a show that undermines your clearly a big conflict that much. Unless that's some simulator room thing.
Yep.
Maybe that's them just screwing around when they're doing their equivalent of a Kobayashi Maru. I suspect his love is genuine, so of course I'm going to try it. I'm sure we'll try it and review an episode or something for this. But are you going to try it?
I'll watch the first episode. It. But yeah, I hope there's more to it than the comedy, because I don't laugh at that trailer.
What
at
if
all.
It's really good and Discovery is weak and it just trumps it completely and we have to switch to a podcast about the Orville?
Well, I guess I'd be happy to have a good show.
You don't think
I
you
guess.
Just you don't think, think that's you, likely, you don't think though. You chug some hemlock?
Nah. I'd get over it. I'd adapt.
I'm happy to hear about Frakes too, by the way. I'm excited. I really like Star Trek First Contact. I remember at some point when I was watching Voyager, I like noted a few episodes I particularly liked, and I was like, "Oh, they were directed by Frakes." So he's clearly got some skills.
Yeah, the first episode he did was the one with Data's daughter, Lol.
Oh, where, interesting.
Yeah, that like I just watched that like a couple of months ago, and yeah. it made me cry.
Oh, wow.
But yeah, I've seen it.
The actress
you know, several
did
times.
A really good job.
Yeah, and I don't know. There's just like a lot of heart. It was really well shot. He's also done like some pretty ambitious episodes that I don't want to list right now. But yeah, he's a good TV director.
He's a good get.
And it would have been embarrassing if they had him on the Orville and if he didn't get invited on the Star Trek Discovery.
Yeah, you got to save face if nothing else.
So I'm glad that he's going to be involved. So we do have some Trek alum, you know, working on the show, even without Brian Fuller anymore. There's still
Nicholas Meyer. I'm sorry, Nick Meyer, and Jonathan Frakes.
But
that's pretty. Those are pretty big.
And Joe Manosky, I think is how you say his name, if I'm remembering it correctly. I mean, he was a writer on The Next Generation and Voyager, and he's on the staff. So. There's definitely more old guard involvement in this than there was in something like, you know, the Kelvin movies.
Right,
which
right.
they had Leonard Nimoy and Majel Barrett did like one or two lines for the computer.
Yeah.
And that was it.
I don't want to quite call it tokenism. Obviously Spock played a major role, but it's slightly tokenism.
You know, it's kind of like in Transformers when Michael Bay got Peter Cullen to do the voice of Optimus Prime. And
but completely bastardized
this
Prime.
Just to shut up the fans that, like, yeah, like, we'll have, like, the same guy do the voice.
Yeah.
but it's still just a stupid robot cartoon movie, and I don't really care about Transformers. Where's my paycheck?
Yeah. It still hurts.
Yeah.
But I heard that new one super stunk.
Well, maybe that franchise will die. They didn't even like it
in Chinese markets.
Oh, yeah, it really sucked then.
Yeah.
Because they love giant robots.
What else we got?
I think that's it. So we'll close on a positive note of
Frakes,
coming in, and
Riker will come in and straddle that directing chair as only Riker can, swinging his foot over, his whole leg over it, I mean, and plunking
and
his
yell,
butt down.
And yell action.
Yes.
And they'll make some of the finest Star Trek television we've ever seen.
We really hope.
I hope. So that's going to be it, and we'll be back to talk about more Discovery news and some of the stuff that's come out, the look at the show. We're going to be talking about the first episode of Star Trek Enterprise pretty soon, and then we'll have covered all the premiere episodes of every show, getting ready for Discovery's premiere. And we also plan to talk about some Star Trek comics in the future. And until next time,
live long and prosper, y'all.
Thank all of you so much for checking out this installment of Text Trek. I hope you enjoyed it. Please be sure to like our YouTube videos and subscribe to our channel. Audio-only versions of episodes are available at our website, www.text-trek.com. Please check out our site, especially if you just want an audio-only podcast. We have that available for you. Y'all can also keep up with us online. You can follow us on Twitter, at TXTrek, or you can check us out on Facebook at www.facebook.com/text-trek. Please, by all means, let us know what you think by dropping a comment anywhere you see fit. We definitely want to hear your feedback. Let us know what you liked and what you would like to see more of, what you would like to see differently going forward. If you want to email me directly, go ahead. I can be reached at fatheryactual@text-trek.com. Thank all y'all again. Take care.